We've set our microphones up on the House floor today to bring you a special message from the President of the United States, which he is sending to the Congress. The House has not as yet been called to order, but we are expecting the Speaker to come to his Speaker's desk in just a few moments and rap the gavel, calling the House to order for this afternoon's business. The Speaker has just come in. He calls the House to order.
Chaplain, the law for prayer. Spirit of the Most High, may we here and now rejoice in the Lord. Express our praise and our gratitude in these sacred moments. Oh, lift us up toward the higher and the better life. Son of righteousness with healing in thy wings, be with men everywhere, teaching them the excellence of thy truth. Inspire them with obedience to thy law, and in all their ways may they acknowledge thy commandments. Almighty God, take out of men's hearts selfishness, revenge, and resentment, and make them a light and a comfort to the weak and the poor everywhere. Grant that liberty may come everywhere, and may men of every station breathe the sweet and the beautiful air of freedom and see the salvation of our God through Christ. Amen. Amen.
Good morning, brother. Amen. You're well this morning, brother.
Thank you. The clerk will read the journal of last day's proceedings.
Thursday, February 4th, 1937. The House called to order by the Speaker. The journal of the proceedings of yesterday was read and approved. Executive communications pursuant to Clause 2, Rule 24 were referred. The message from the Senate by Mr. Crockett, its chief clerk, announced that the Senate had passed with amendments in which the concurrence of the House is requested the bill of the House of the following title, H.R. 3587. Mr. Warren, by direction of the Committee on Accounts, pursuant to Clause 45, Rule 11, reported, report number 173, the following resolution, House Resolution 97, when said resolution was considered and agreed to. Mr. Warren, by direction of the Committee on Accounts, pursuant to Clause 45, Rule 11, reported, report number 174, the following resolution, House Resolution 108, when said resolution was considered and agreed to. On motion of Mr. Buchanan, by unanimous consent, the bill H.R. 3587, making appropriations to supply deficiencies in certain appropriations and for other purposes, was taken from the Speaker's table, the amendments of the Senate thereto, and on motion of Mr. Buchanan, resolved that the House disagreed with the amendments of the Senate and ask a conference with the Senate on the disagreeing votes of the two houses thereon. Thereupon, the Speaker announced the appointment of Mr. Buchanan, Mr. Taylor of Colorado, Mr. Woodrum, Mr. Tabor, and Mr. Bacon, managers on the part of the House at said conference. Order that the clerk notify the Senate thereof. The House proceeded to the consideration of the resolution, House Resolution number 96, requesting the Secretary of Labor to furnish the House of Representatives with all information available on the automobile strike, pending when the House adjourned on yesterday. After debate, on motion of Mr. Connery, said resolution was laid on the table. Mr. Doughton moved that the House resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole House on the State of the Union for consideration of the Joint Resolution, House Joint Resolution 96, to extend the authority of the President under Section 350 of the Tariff Act of 1930 as amended. Pending which, on motion of Mr. Doughton, by unanimous consent, ordered that the time for general debate be limited to 10 hours, be equally divided, be controlled by Mr. Doughton and Mr. Treadway. The motion of the House resolve itself into the Committee was then agreed to. Accordingly, the House resolved itself into the Committee of the Whole House on the State of the Union for consideration of said bill, and after some time spent therein, the Speaker resumed the chair when Mr. Meade, chairman, reported that the committee, having had under consideration said bill, had come to no resolution thereon. On motion of Mr. Treadway, by unanimous consent, ordered that on tomorrow, immediately after reading of the journal and disposition of business on the Speaker's table, he be permitted to address the House for 5 minutes. A joint resolution of the Senate of the following title was taken from the Speaker's table and under the rule referred. Senate Joint Resolution number 38. By unanimous consent, leave of absence was granted to Mr. Dingell indefinitely to to Mr. Cernovich indefinitely, and then on motion of Mr. Rayburn, at 5:00 and 46 minutes p.m., the House adjourns.
Without objection, the journal will stand approved. The chair is asked to make the following announcement. Pursuant to the provisions of Public Resolution 4, approved February 3rd, 1937, the chair appoints, as members of the Joint Committee on Government Organization, the following members of the House: Mr. Buchanan, Mr. Cochran, Mr. Warren, Mr. Benson of Kentucky, Mr. Robinson of Utah, Mr. Meade, Mr. Niffin, Mr. Tabor, and Mr. Gifford. What purpose does the gentleman who takes this ride?
I ask the gentleman to take from the Speaker's desk, SJ Resolution number 20, and ask for committee consideration.
Is there objection to the request of the gentleman from Texas? Clerk will report the Senate Joint Resolution.
Senate Joint Resolution number 20. Joint Resolution authorizing the President to invite the Pan-American Republics and the Dominion of Canada to participate in the proposed Greater Texas and Pan-American Exposition. Resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that the President of the United States is authorized and requested by proclamation or in such manner as he may deem proper to invite the Pan-American Republics and the Dominion of Canada to participate in the proposed Greater Texas and Pan-American Exposition to be held in the city of Dallas in the state of Texas during the year 1937.
Is there objection to the request of the gentleman from Texas?
I have the right to object to ask the gentleman quick. I understand this is frankly
continuing the exposition that was held there last year.
The gentleman is correct. We have an exposition that was held in 1936 with a $25,000 investment. We want to continue this year under the name of the Pan-American Exposition to the countries of South America to lead descendants civics. And will invite this country, authorize the President to invite those countries and candidates to participate in this Pan-American expedition and utilize the plans that we already have.
Well, is it intended to ask for an additional appropriation later? No additional.
It doesn't call for any. It's my understanding that no new appropriation will be asked for.
Well, we've been pretty generous, and I want to take this opportunity to call our attention to it, because the greatest city in the United States probably will ask for something before this session is over. I want to take this opportunity to call the attention of the House to our generosity in the past. I have no objection.
Say, I have no objection. The question is on third reading of the Senate resolution. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. Third reading.
Joint resolution authorizing the President to invite the Pan-American Republics and the Dominion of Canada to participate in the proposed Greater Texas and Pan-American Exposition.
Questions on the passage? Many in favor will say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The resolution is agreed to. What purpose does the gentleman from motion to reconsider laid on the table? A similar House resolution without objection will be laid on the table. What purpose does the gentleman from Maine rise? Will the gentleman withhold that for a moment?
Speak a message from the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker.
The Secretary.
Directed by the President of the United States, delivered to the House of Representatives a message in writing. Thank
you. And there you've heard the announcement of Colonel Sinnott, doorkeeper of the House of Representatives, of the arrival of a messenger from the President of the United States, and the words of the messenger that here is a message from the President of the United States. The message is being opened now, removed from the envelope, and laid before the speaker on his desk. In just a few moments, it will be handed to one of the reading clerks and will be read by...
Laid before the House, the following message from the President of the United States, which the clerk will read.
And here is the message read by A.E. Chaffee.
To the Congress of the United States, I have recently called the attention of the Congress to the clear need for a comprehensive program to reorganize the administrative machinery of the executive branch of our government. I now make a similar recommendation to the Congress in regard to the judicial branch of the government in order that it also may function in accord with modern necessities. The Constitution provides that the President shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. No one else is given a similar mandate. It is therefore the duty of the President to advise the Congress in regard to the judiciary whenever he deems such information or recommendation necessary. I address you for the further reason that the Constitution vests in the Congress direct responsibility in the creation of courts and judicial offices and in the formulation of rules of practice and procedure. It is, therefore, one of the definite duties of the Congress constantly to maintain the effective functioning of the federal judiciary. The judiciary has often found itself handicapped by insufficient personnel with which to meet a growing and more complex business. It is true that the physical facilities of conducting the business of the courts have been greatly improved in recent years through the erection of suitable quarters, the provision of adequate libraries, and the addition of subordinate court officers. But in many ways, these are merely the trappings of judicial office. They play a minor part in the processes of justice. Since the earliest days of the Republic, the problem of the personnel of the courts has needed the attention of the Congress. For example, from the beginning, over repeated protests to President Washington, the justices of the Supreme Court were required to ride circuit and as circuit justices to hold trials throughout the length and breadth of the land, a practice which endured over a century. In almost every decade since 1789, changes have been made by the Congress whereby the numbers of judges and the duties of judges in federal courts have been altered in one way or another. The Supreme Court was established with 6 members in 1789. It was reduced to 5 in 1801. It was increased to 7 in 1807. It was increased to 9 in 1837. It was increased to 10 in 1863. It was reduced to 7 in 1866. It was increased to 9 in 1869. The simple fact is that today a new need for legislative action arises because the personnel of the federal judiciary is insufficient to meet the business before them. A growing body of our citizens complain of the complexities, the delays, and the expense of litigation in the United States courts. A letter from the Attorney General, which I submit herewith, justifies by reasoning and statistics the common impression created by our overcrowded federal dockets, and it proves the need for additional judges. Delay in any court results in injustice. It makes lawsuits a luxury available only to the few who can afford them or who have property interests to protect, which are sufficiently large to repay the cost. Poorer litigants are compelled to abandon valuable rights or to accept inadequate or unjust settlements because of sheer inability to finance or to await the end of a long litigation. Only by speeding up the processes of the law and thereby reducing their costs can we eradicate the growing impression that the courts are chiefly a haven for the well-to-do. Delays in the determination of appeals have the same effect. Moreover, if trials of original actions are expedited and existing accumulations of cases are reduced, the volume of work imposed on the circuit courts of appeals will further increase. The attainment of speedier justice in the courts below will enlarge the task of the Supreme Court itself. And still more work would be added by the recommendation which I make later in this message for the quicker determination of constitutional questions by the highest court. Even at the present time, the Supreme Court is laboring under a heavy burden. Its difficulties in this respect were superficially lightened some years ago by authorizing the court in its discretion to refuse to hear appeals in many classes of cases. This discretion was so freely exercised that in the last fiscal year, although 867 petitions for review were presented to the Supreme Court, it declined to hear 717 cases. If petitions in behalf of the government are excluded, it appears that the court permitted private litigants to prosecute appeals in only 108 cases out of 803 applications. Many of the refusals were doubtless warranted. But can it be said that full justice is achieved when a court is forced by the sheer necessity of keeping up with its business to decline, without even an explanation, to hear 87% of the cases presented to it by private litigants? It seems clear, therefore, that the necessity of relieving present congestion extends to the enlargement of the capacity of all the federal courts. A part of the problem of obtaining a sufficient number of judges to dispose of cases is the capacity of the judges themselves. This brings forward the question of aged or infirm judges, a subject of delicacy and yet one which requires frank discussion. In the federal courts, there are in all 237 life tenure permanent judgeships. 25 of them are now held by judges over 70 years of age and eligible to leave the bench on full pay. Originally, no pension or retirement allowance was provided by the Congress. When, after 80 years of our national history, the Congress made provision for pensions, it found a well-entrenched tradition among judges to cling to their posts, in many instances far beyond their years of physical or mental capacity. Their salaries were small. As with other men, responsibilities and obligations accumulated. No alternative had been open to them except to attempt to perform the duties of their offices to the very edge of the grave. In exceptional cases, of course, judges, like other men, retain to an advanced age full mental and physical vigor. Those not so fortunate are often unable to perceive their own infirmities. They seem to be tenacious of the appearance of adequacy. The voluntary retirement law of 1869 provided, therefore, only a partial solution. That law, still in force, has not proved effective in inducing aged justices, judges, to retire on a pension. This result had been foreseen in the debates when the measure was being considered. It was then proposed that when a judge refused to retire upon reaching the age of 70, an additional judge should be appointed to assist in the work of the court. The proposal passed the House, but was eliminated in the Senate. With the opening of the 20th century and the great increase of population and commerce and the growth of a more complex type of litigation, similar proposals were introduced in the Congress. To meet the situation, in 1913, 1914, 1915, and 1916, the Attorneys General, then in office, recommended to the Congress that when a district or a circuit judge failed to retire at the age of 70, an additional judge be appointed in order that the affairs of the court might be promptly and adequately discharged. In 1919, a law was finally passed providing that the president may appoint additional district and circuit judges, but only upon a finding that the incumbent judge over 70 is unable to discharge efficiently all the duties of his office by reason of mental or physical disability of permanent character. The discretionary and indefinite nature of this legislation has rendered it ineffective. No president should be asked to determine the ability or disability of any particular judge. The duty of a judge involves more than presiding or listening to testimony or arguments. It is well to remember that the mass of details involved in the average of law cases today is vastly greater and more complicated than even 20 years ago. Records and briefs must be read. Statutes, decisions, and extensive material of a technical, scientific, statistical, and economic nature must be searched and studied. Opinions must be formulated and written. The modern task of judges calls for the use of full energies. modern complexities call also for a constant infusion of new blood in the courts, just as it is needed in executive functions of the government and in private business. A lowered mental or physical vigor leads man to avoid an examination of complicated and changed conditions. Little by little, new facts become blurred through old glasses fitted, as it were, for the needs of another generation. Older men, assuming that the scene is the same as it was in the past, cease to explore or inquire into the present or the future. We have recognized this truth in the civil service of the nation and of many states by compelling retirement on pay at the age of 70. We have recognized it in the Army and Navy by retiring officers at the age of 64. A number of states have recognized it by providing in their constitutions for compulsory retirement of aged judges. Life tenure of judges assured by the Constitution was designed to place the courts beyond temptations or influences which might impair their judgments. It was not intended to create a static judiciary. A constant and systematic addition of younger blood will vitalize the courts and better equip them to recognize and apply the essential concepts of justice in the light of the needs and the facts of an ever-changing world. It is obvious, therefore, from both reason and experience, that some provision must be adopted which will operate automatically to supplement the work of older judges and accelerate the work of the court. I therefore earnestly recommend that the necessity of an increase in the number of judges be supplied by legislation providing for the appointment of additional judges in all federal courts without exception where there are incumbent judges of retirement age who do not choose to retire or to resign. If an elder judge is not in fact incapacitated, only good can come from the presence of an additional judge in the crowded state of the dockets. If the capacity of an elder judge is in fact impaired, the appointment of an additional judge is indispensable. This seems to be a truth which cannot be contradicted. I also recommend that the Congress provide machinery for taking care of sudden or long-standing congestion in the lower courts. The Supreme Court should be given power to appoint an administrative assistant, who may be called a proctor. He would be charged with the duty of watching the calendars and the business of all the courts in the federal system. The Chief Justice thereupon should be authorized to make a temporary assignment of any circuit or district judge hereafter appointed in order that he may serve as long as needed in any circuit or district where the courts are in arrears. I attach a carefully considered draft of a proposed bill, which, if enacted, would, I am confident, afford substantial relief. The proposed measure also contains a limit on the total number of judges who might thus be appointed, and also a limit on the potential size of any one of our federal courts. These proposals do not raise any issue of constitutional law. They do not suggest any form of compulsory retirement for incumbent judges. Indeed, those who have reached the retirement age but desire to continue their judicial work would be able to do so under less physical and mental strain and would be able to play a useful part in relieving the growing congestion in the business of our courts. Among them are men of eminence and great ability, whose services the government would be loath to lose. If, on the other hand, any judge eligible for retirement should feel that his court would suffer because of an increase in its membership, he may retire or resign under already existing provisions of law if he wishes so to do. In this connection, let me say that the pending proposal to extend to the justices of the Supreme Court the same retirement privileges now available to other federal judges has my entire approval. One further matter requires immediate attention. We have witnessed the spectacle of conflicting decisions in both trial and appellate courts on the constitutionality of every form of important legislation. Such a welter of uncomposed differences of judicial opinion has brought the law, the courts, and indeed the entire administration of justice, dangerously near to disrepute. A federal statute is held legal by one judge in one district. It is simultaneously held illegal by another judge in another district. An act valid in one judicial circuit is invalid in another judicial circuit. Thus, rights fully accorded to one group of citizens may be denied to others. As a practical matter, this means that for periods running as long as 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, until final determination can be made by the Supreme Court, the law loses its most indispensable element, equality. Moreover, during the long processes of preliminary motions, original trials, petitions for rehearings, appeals, reversals on technical grounds requiring retrials, motions before the Supreme Court, and the final hearing by the highest tribunal, during all this time, labor, industry, agriculture, commerce, and the government itself go through an unconscionable period of uncertainty and embarrassment. And it is well to remember that during these long processes, the normal operations of society and government are handicapped in many cases by differing and divided opinions in the lower courts and by the lack of any clear guide for the dispatch of business. Thereby, our legal system is fast losing another essential of justice, certainty. Finally, we find the processes of government itself brought to a complete stop from time to time by injunctions issued almost automatically, sometimes even without notice to the government, and not infrequently, in clear violation of the principle of equity, that injunctions should be granted only in those rare cases of manifest illegality and irreparable damage against which the ordinary course of the law offers no protection. Statutes which the Congress enacts are set aside or suspended for long periods of time, even in cases to which the government is not a party. In the uncertain state of the law, it is not difficult for the ingenious to devise novel reasons for attacking the validity of new legislation or its application. While these questions are laboriously brought to issue and debated through a series of courts, the government must stand aside. It matters not that the Congress has enacted the law, that the executive has signed it, and that the administrative machinery is waiting to function. Government, by injunction, lays a heavy hand upon normal processes, and no important statute can take effect against any individual or organization with the means to employ lawyers and engage in wide-flung litigation until it has passed through the whole hierarchy of the courts. Thus, the judiciary, by postponing the effective date of acts of the Congress, is assuming an additional function and is coming more and more to constitute a scattered, loosely organized, and slowly operating third house of the national legislature. This state of affairs has come upon the nation gradually over a period of decades. In my annual message to this Congress, I expressed some views and some hopes. Now, as an immediate step, I recommend that the Congress provide that no decision, injunction, judgment, or decree on any constitutional question be promulgated by any federal court without previous and ample notice to the Attorney General and an opportunity for the United States to present evidence and be heard. This is to prevent court action on the constitutionality of acts of the Congress in suits between private individuals where the government is not a party to the suit without giving opportunity to the government of the United States to defend the law of the land. I also earnestly recommend that in cases in which any court of first instance determines a question of constitutionality, the Congress provide that there shall be a direct and immediate appeal to the Supreme Court. And that such cases take precedence over all other matters pending in that court. Such legislation will, I am convinced, go far to alleviate the inequality, uncertainty, and delay in the disposition of vital questions of constitutionality arising under our fundamental law. My desire is to strengthen the administration of justice and to make it a more effective servant of public need. In the American ideal of government, the courts find an essential and constitutional place. In striving to fulfill this ideal, not only the judges, but the Congress and the executive as well must do all in their power to bring the judicial organization and personnel to the high standards of usefulness which sound and efficient government and modern conditions require. This message has dealt with four present needs. First, to eliminate congestion of calendars and to make the judiciary as a whole less static by the constant and systematic addition of new blood to its personnel. Second, to make the judiciary more elastic by providing for temporary transfers of circuit and district judges to those places where federal courts are most in arrears. Third, to furnish the Supreme Court practical assistance in supervising the conduct of business in the lower courts. Fourth, to eliminate inequality, uncertainty, and delay now existing in the determination of constitutional questions involving federal statutes. If we increase the personnel of the federal courts so that cases may be promptly decided in the first instance and may be given adequate and prompt hearing on all appeals, if we invigorate all the courts by the persistent infusion of new blood, if we grant to the Supreme Court further power and responsibility in maintaining the efficiency of the entire federal judiciary, and if we assure government participation in the speedier consideration and final determination of all constitutional questions, we shall go a long way toward our high objectives. If these measures achieve their aim, we may be relieved of the necessity of considering any fundamental changes in the powers of the courts or the constitution of our government, changes which involve consequences so far-reaching as to cause uncertainty as to the wisdom of such course. Franklin D. Roosevelt, the White House, February 5th, 1937.
House will be in order. The message of the President with the accompanying documents will be referred to the Committee on the Judiciary and ordered printed. What purpose does the gentleman take to drive?
I think I ask you now for a present consideration of Senate 974 with the amendments reported by the House Committee on Reconciliation.
The gentleman from Texas asks unanimous consent.
Now, Mr. Speaker, let's have our report started.
I'm
going to
make a disconnect these things. I'll see if you can't disconnect. Disconnect these things. House will be in order. All members will kindly cease conversation. By the large attendance this morning.
Simultaneously with its reading in the House, the message has been read in the United States Senate, where it was delivered first, and then the messenger from the White House came direct to the House of Representatives. The House opened its session with prayer by the Reverend James Sherrill Montgomery, as is its daily custom, and that was followed by the reading of the journal, and then some miscellaneous affairs were taken up for a few moments, pending the arrival of the messenger from the President. Messages from the President of the United States are privileged before the two houses of Congress and consequently were brought up immediately upon its arrival here. The House now is going into its regular afternoon session. They're going to continue their regular business of the day, which is a continuation of the debate on the reciprocal trade treaties. As you know, those treaties, the right of the President to negotiate with other nations for foreign trade, expire as of June 30th. and the House at present time, after having 5.5 hours of debate yesterday, will have another 4.5 hours debate today on the bill providing for the extension of the right of the president to negotiate in that manner for another 3 years. The message from the president on the judiciary has been referred to the Committee on the Judiciary, which is headed by Representative Hatton W. Summers of Texas as chairman. In the Senate, it will also, following its reading there, be referred to the Senate Committee on Judiciary, and the chairman of that committee is the Honorable Henry F. Ashurst of Arizona. And now, to give you comment and analysis on the message of the president, we're going to take you from the House of Representatives to our studios, and it's our pleasure to introduce Mr. J. Fred Essery, chief of the Washington Bureau of the Baltimore Sun. Mr. Essery.
Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, if I seem a little bit breathless at the moment, you must excuse me. I have just come from the most extraordinary press conference perhaps ever held by a president of the United States. In the course of that press conference, Mr. Roosevelt, without any warning or any notice whatever to the public, read to us, some 200 newspaper correspondents, the entire text of his message to the Congress today on the reform of the judiciary. Now, that message has just been read to you as it was delivered in the House of Representatives and in the Senate of the United States. Not all of you who heard the reading of this message in Congress on the reform may have realized that you were hearing one of the most daring state papers in the lifetime of this generation. But I assure you that it was exactly that. It was daring, even dramatic, in that the president, after all the conflict between himself and the Supreme Court that has continued now for the better part of 4 years, after all that was debated in the campaign, after all that seemed to have been settled by the election, should now propose to save his program of legislation, that is to say, to save the New Deal. He now proposes to pack the Supreme Court of the United States. Of course, his friends will insist with some heat that he is doing nothing of the sort. But how can they be convincing? They cannot, in my judgment. For the president proposes to Congress, in the name of reorganization and of reform, that he be allowed, if the need should rise, to increase the membership of the Supreme Court to 15. He proposes to do this by appointing a new member for every jurist on that bench who has reached the age of 70 after serving 10 years and who does not voluntarily retire. He would not throw the aged men off the bench bodily. That would be too cruel, too brutal, we may assume. What he says, however, he says in plain words. He says that their experience and their services in most instances is of the greatest possible value to the nation. Talking, of course, about the more aged members of that court. But he says also that the work is too much, entirely too much, for aged men to bear. Nothing very tender or solicitous about that, is there? He says there is delay and there is congestion in the dockets of the courts of the United States, delay and congestion which reaches to the very highest bench itself. He says that there are literally hundreds of appeals to the Supreme Court, which are denied without so much as a hearing. Nearly 700 in a single year. And he says, furthermore, if justice is to be done to all litigants, then all must be given a fair hearing by a court with the capacity to hear all. All of that, let me put in, is on the soft side of the matter. It is to bolster up the case the president makes in favor of decisions that are not dictated by men, as he puts it, living in the past and not in the present. Yes, he said that too. It is one of the harshest things said about the Supreme Court in any responsible quarter in my recollection. That majority of the court is living in the past, as he put it. Of course, Mr. Roosevelt said substantially the same thing, remember, 2 years ago, when he denounced the court's decision outlawing the NRA as taking the court back to the horse and buggy days of government. Now there's another thing, and I have only time to discuss it briefly. Another thing of transcendent significance in today's message was in the nature of a warning. In it, the president told Congress that the only alternative to a reform in the personnel and supreme and procedure of the courts is a constitutional amendment. He didn't give the outlines of that amendment. He merely referred to it in the most general terms. But he made it perfectly plain to all of us at his press conference, and I should say he made it plain to every member of the House and Senate who heard the reading of the message. He meant a change in the organic law that would deprive the Supreme Court of the power to pass upon the constitutionality of acts of Congress. That would be a most radical change, I might say a revolutionary change, in the general setup, in the general check and balance system of our federal government. And such an amendment, let me put in, as I have only a half a minute more, such an amendment might have even wider signification. It might even deal with the issues upon which the President and the Supreme Court have been at odds for the better part of 3 years. I direct your attention to these two high points of this message because, in my judgment, they are the most sensational pieces of news that I, as a news writer, have dealt with since the armistice a good many years ago. And I thank you.
We are speaking to you once more from the House of Representatives, where we have broadcast just a little earlier the reading of the President's message on reorganization of the judiciary. The House is practically entirely filled now, although as the reading of the message was begun, there were very few members on the floor of the House. It's our belief that perhaps many of them did not expect this message to come over today and were not real prompt in arriving at the House chamber at 12 o'clock in order to be here as its reading was begun. The usual number of people occupy the galleries, and at the present time, the House has begun its afternoon work, the consideration of the reciprocal agreements, extension of the right of the president to negotiate reciprocal trade agreements with other nations throughout the world. This message was a rather lengthy one as presidential messages go, and as the president said at the beginning of his message, it is the right and privilege and duty of the president to keep the Congress informed on the State of the Union. And now, coming to our microphone, is the Honorable Newt Hill, Member of Congress from the State of Washington. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill?
And about a minute?
Yes, or just however you'd like to talk. We'd like for you to give us any comments that you care to make on this message which the President has sent over to the Congress today. Mr. Representative Newt Hill of Washington.
I consider this message of the President probably the most important that has come before the Congress in the 4 years that I have been a member of this Congress. Its frankness certainly is refreshing, and I feel that in the long run that it is absolutely fair both to the judiciary department or branch of the government and as well as the executive and the legislative branch. I believe if we carry out the things that have been suggested by the President in this message, that the government will perform its duties more efficiently and more equitably towards all the people of the United States. And I certainly hope that the suggestions made by the President will be carried out by the present Congress in this session.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Hill. Representative Newt Hill of Washington, a member of Congress who has given you his comments on the message of the President. And now we're going to introduce to you the Honorable H. Jerry Voris of California, a Democratic member of Congress now serving his first term in the House of Representatives. And we'd like to introduce him for any comments that he'd care to make on the message which the President has sent to the Congress. Representative Voris.
Thank you very much. Of course, we have just heard the President's message and just had a moment or two to glance through it. And none of us are quite as familiar with all that it contains as we'd like to be before speaking to the country about it. However, it's very plain that once again President Roosevelt has asserted that great leadership which he has been giving this country in the last few years. It's very plain that he has based his argument on the soundest possible constitutional ground, pointing out that it is a duty of Congress to maintain the effective functioning of the federal judiciary, and further, that the duty of Congress is obviously to see to it that effective government in all branches is given to our people in these difficult and critical times through which we're now passing. As I understand, the most important and fundamental suggestions of the President will make it possible for additions to be made in all courts of the United States, including the Supreme Court, of additional justices and judges, where there are judges who have reached the age of 70 years. And furthermore, that in all cases involving the constitutionality of statutes, that the government will have opportunity to present its case, and that wherever a lower court makes a declaration of constitutionality, that from that decision, an immediate appeal goes to the Supreme Court so that immediate action can be obtained upon it. I'm very grateful to the Broadcasting Company for giving me this chance to speak to you, and wish I'd had more time to think this over beforehand, but it's plain that the President has given us the kind of leadership that I'm sure the country was wanting and looking to him for, and you may be assured that the Congress will respond earnestly.
Thank you very much, Representative Voris. The Honorable H. Jerry Voris, member of Congress from California, now serving his first term in the Congress, and he's given you his comments on the message of the President of the United States. Representative Voris has been interested in the matter contained in the President's message for quite a number of years. We hope in just a moment or two to have some comments from additional members of the House of Representatives, and all of them are vitally interested in this message of the President. One way or another, we're sure of that. And now coming across the House floor toward our microphone, the Honorable Hatton W. Sumners, Chairman of the House Committee on Judiciary, to whose committee the message of the President has been referred. Representative Sumners was a member of the group which attended a conference at the White House this morning to discuss the proposed message of the President. Ladies and gentlemen, we present the Honorable Hatton W. Sumners, Chairman of the Committee on the Judiciary, for his comments on the President's message.
The committee will appreciate the very great importance of this message. As chairman of the Committee on the Judiciary, I introduced, and the committee has reported favorably, a bill authorizing and permitting judges of the Supreme Court to retire instead of resign, the same privilege which is now accorded to judges of the district courts and of the circuit courts of appeals. I also introduced, and the committee has favorably reported, a bill directing the judge of a federal court before whom private litigation is pending, constitutionality of an act of Congress is attacked, to make it possible for the Attorney General to intervene in that case and to defend the constitutionality of the Act of Congress. With regard to the other suggestions contained in the President's message, the Committee on the Judiciary will take them under consideration and give them as speedy attention as possible.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for your comments. That was the Honorable Hatton W. Sumners, Member of Congress from Texas and Chairman of the House Committee on Judiciary, to whose committee the President's message has been referred. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is our pleasure to introduce the Honorable Hamilton Fish, Member of Congress from New York, Republican Member of Congress from New York, for any comments which he may care to make on the message of the President. Representative Fish.
I've just listened in the House of Representatives to the reading of the President's message on the Supreme Court. The shades of Oliver Wendell Holmes, who until he was 90 years of age served on the court and was one of the most preeminent of its liberal members. It seems to me that the message of the President is sheer political hypocrisy. Its sole purpose is to pack the Supreme Court with a favorable majority for unconstitutional New Deal measures. The President practically informs the American people that Chief Justice Hughes, Justice Brandeis, and a majority of the court are unfit and disqualified as being superannuated. If the logic and reasoning power of the President is correct, then Senators Borah, Norris, and Johnson should automatically retire from public life. By the same token, former Chief Justices Marshall, Waite, Fuller, White, and Taft were not fit to serve after they had reached the age of 70. The President's message is typical of his repeatedly expressed views and sneering attitude on the Supreme Court of the United States. I, for one, both as an American and as a Republican, am glad that this message has been dragged out into the public to be considered by the American people, and I believe when it is fully considered, the American people will approve the Supreme Court and take not one single power away from them to hold the acts of Congress unconstitutional, unless it be the 5-4 decisions which undermine the authority of the court at times. That is the one single exception I am prepared to make. I am willing to vote for a constitutional amendment to override the Supreme Court by a 2/3 vote of the Congress in case of unfavorable 5-4 decisions. Otherwise, I'm not in favor of limiting or curbing the powers of the Supreme Court as they stand today.
Thank you very much. Representative Fish of New York has spoken to you, a Republican member of Congress, giving you his views on the message of the President. And now it's our pleasure to present another Republican member of Congress, the Honorable Alan Treadway, for 24 years, a member of Congress from the state of Massachusetts. Representative Treadway.
Time has not permitted a sufficient study of such a very important message as that to which we have just listened. No previous announcement was made that there was to be such a message delivered or as to its contents. I therefore feel very much unprepared to express any definite views. I think this message is one of the important, most important messages I've ever listened to, and that it should be carefully studied not only by the members of Congress, but by the people of the country who the congressmen represent. Now, it seems to me that we would perhaps have more confidence in the recommendations of the President if we were not so thoroughly familiar with the methods of procedure and the criticisms that have been made of decisions of the Supreme Court relative to certain types of so-called New Deal legislation. It is possible that the courts should in some way be augmented or revamped in view of the tremendous amount of business now being transacted by them. But I, for one, would have a greater respect for the recommendations of the President of the United States if they did not seem to me to be distinctly directed at the failure of the court to carry out the administration's viewpoint in the decisions it has rendered. And therefore, for the present, I intend to remain open-minded as to the merits of the bill, and particularly of the possibilities of action thereon by Congress itself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Treadway. Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard the comments of the Honorable Alan Treadway, member of Congress from Massachusetts, commenting on the message of the President providing for reorganization of the judiciary. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we've presented from the House of Representatives the message of the President as read by the reading clerk and the comments of some of the members on both sides of the House on that message. We're going to take you now over to the Senate wing of the United States Capitol building, to the Senate wing.
The United States Senate has just adjourned for the day, and we take it out of this committee room, which is adjacent to the Senate chamber, and to which room we have invited the Honorable Joseph T. Robinson of Arkansas, the Majority Leader of the Senate. Senator Robinson has been very gracious to come in here to give his observations and opinion of the message on the judiciary. Senator Robinson.
It represents the result of a prolonged study extending over a period of several weeks, which studies were participated in by the Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Cummins, and many others. It proposes a reorganization of all federal courts on a plan comparable to that embraced in the message recently read to the Congress relating to the reorganization of the executive departments and independent bureaus and commissions. Briefly, the message contemplates the appointment of additional Supreme Court, Circuit, and District Court judges in all cases where the justices fail to avail themselves of the retirement privilege after they have reached the age of 70 and one-half years. There's also a limitation in the act, or proposed act, as to the number of judges. The Supreme Court justices can never exceed 15. And if the justices avail themselves of the privilege of retirement, the number will be limited to 9. The principle of the proposed legislation is made applicable to all courts. The prospective arrangement in the plan for the prompt determination of constitutional issues by the highest tribunal is, I believe, admirable, and it cannot encounter serious opposition. The suggestion for the creation of a proctor who shall keep the Supreme Court advised as to the status of business in the several courts throughout the country will help to assure the prompt dispatch of business on all the dockets. The program of the message, from my standpoint, is in no sense a violent innovation. It follows procedure in some respects that has heretofore been pursued with regard to increase in the judges of the various courts. It does not require or contemplate a large additional expenditure from the federal treasury. It looks to the dispatch of business and to the restoration or establishment of a principle of equality as among the various litigants seeking redress in the courts. To me, it appears likely that the substantial recommendations in the message will receive favorable consideration by the Senate. I have heretofore indicated my willingness to participate in amending the Constitution to conform to decisions heretofore reached by the court. If the process pursued in this recommendation is followed, there will be infused into the courts new blood, and in all probability, as stated by the President in his message, there will be no necessity for amending the Constitution. I thank you.
Thank you, Senator Robinson. And now another distinguished member of the Senate has come into our microphone position here in the Foreign Affairs or Military Affairs Committee room. He is the Honorable Sherman Minton, Senator from Indiana and a member of the Interstate Commerce Committee. Senator Minton.
It was inevitable that Congress would take up at this session the question of what should be done with the court in its relation to our governmental affairs. I'm glad that the President has taken that leadership. And in his message this morning, he has made a very sensible and statesmanlike approach to this problem. When we are confronted with any legislation in Congress, we must first determine whether we can do it, and next, whether or not it's advisable to do it. There can be no question about the constitutionality of this approach. And in my opinion, there could be no serious objection to doing the thing that the President proposes to do. It's been perfectly evident to lawyers and folks that have studied the court situation for a number of years that some comprehensive program should be adopted with reference to the courts. This program, as outlined by the President, will undoubtedly meet that situation and will comprehend the other problems that are being mooted today about the court. I have had some ideas about what should be done. I am not sure that my proposal is inconsistent with the ideas espoused by the President, and that what I have proposed should not be done also. However, for the moment, I am checking out on my idea and heartily supporting the President.
Another prominent member of the Senate on Capitol Hill is the Honorable Gerald Nye of North Dakota, chairman of the Special Committee on Munitions Investigation and of many other important Senate committees. Senator Nye.
Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, how to prevent an individual or a corporation to indefinitely hold up legislation by attacking its constitutionality has long been a most perplexing question. It seems to me that the President's recommendation now to bring about a speeding up of final court decision in these questions is ingenious to say the least and ought to have the wide backing of the people of this country and such action at the hands of Congress as will expedite the accomplishment of legislation to bring about this speeding up program. Thank you.
And thank you, Senator Nye. You have heard from this wing of the Capitol building three distinguished senators giving their comments on the President's message. And now we return you to the House side and our position in the record room.
Senator. And may we add that Senator Robinson, who you heard from the Senate side, was a member of the special group from Capitol Hill, which this morning conferred with the President on the message which he has this noon sent to the Capitol. Also attending the conference were the members of the Cabinet, the Vice President of the United States, Senator Henry F. Ashurst, chairman of the House Committee, Senate Committee on Judiciary. Representative Patton W. Sumners of Texas, chairman of the House Committee on Judiciary. Representative Sam Rayburn of Texas, majority leader of the House, and the Speaker of the House, the Honorable William B. Bankhead, who has presided over the session this morning. The President's message, the reading of the President's message, was begun just after 12 o'clock. We carried it, and following that, you've heard the comments of some of the leading members of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. Also, Mr. J. Fred Essery, chief of the Washington Bureau of the Baltimore Sun, gave you his comments as a veteran newspaper man on the message on reorganization of the judiciary.